something. Something huge, at least as massive as itself. Eight of the crewmen carried a 2-foot-wide long section of the log to the bow. It was easily 30 feet in length. They looped ropes and began to fasten it to the front of the ship so that it stuck out 20 feet from the bow, dipping down towards the waterline at the end, skimming the water. Curiosity filled him, but he had more pressing issues. The crew stared him down, their ill intent visible on their faces. Facing such a pitiless crew, Wyatt's words echoed through his head.
Strike when the time is right, not before. Wait for the perfect moment.
He was powerless against these men. He had to try a different angle than useless, angry posturing. It would be wiser to wait and see how they treated him and find out who they were before he leapt to conclusions, or leapt back into the river.
Thanks for fishing me out of the river. I appreciate it,
Kenny said, self-consciously standing there in only a shirt and his boxers. Who are you? What were you doing out there floating in the river? One of the men asked.
I fell off of a boat,
Kenny said. He didn't want to say too much more. If he mentioned the ship's name and they were Tweed's men, he would be in deep trouble. What boat? What was the name of the ship you were on?
I don't know. I can't remember the name of it,
Kenny said. The man sneered and cocked his head towards the river. If you don't like our company, we can put you back in the river where we found you. I don't know who you are or what you're up to, but you smell like trouble to me. Boys, toss him back in, the man said. Strong arms grabbed Kenny, and he was nearly over the rail again when a woman's voice called out.
Put him down,
she said, with authority. The crewman set him down on his feet, but kept a firm grip on his arms.
Answer me truthfully, or I'll let them toss you in,
the woman said. She kept Kenny fixed in her unforgiving gaze.
Tell me the truth. Who are you? Why were you in the river?
Kenny weighed his options, but knew there was no other choice but to tell her the truth and hope for the best. Whoever she was, this woman was no fool. She looked like she could spot a lie in an instant, and she didn't look like she made idle threats. He would be tossed back into the river, this time with nothing to use as a float, and he'd be as good as dead. If she worked for Tweed, he was as good as dead anyway.
My name is Kenny Miller. I'm trying to find my fiancé and mother.
I told you not to lie to me, boy. You were floating down the river looking for your fiancé and mother. Are you crazy or an idiot? You'll need a better story than that.
She turned to the crew and commanded,
Toss him over.
Halfway over the railing, Kenny reached out and latched onto the rail with both hands, clutching at the railing in a death grip. He hooked his leg through the railing, using all of his strength to resist the men trying to toss him over.
It's true,
Kenny shouted, the words spilling from his mouth frantically.
My fiancée was kidnapped and her family was killed. My mother and I tracked her to Huntington and we tried to rescue her, but my mother got caught. I tried to get help from a cop there, but he turned me over to Tweed.
Who? What name did you say?
She asked.
The cop called him Tweed.
The woman glared at him for a moment longer and then motioned to the crew.
Bring him back on board, boys. Let's hear what he has to say.
She turned her gaze to Kenny and her voice softened a bit.
Tell me what happened to you, Kenny.
The cop handed me over to some Martin Hale security men, and they put me in a prison car, a railroad car. There were two other guys there with me. The guards were going to ship us to a prison camp, but me and the other prisoners killed the guards and escaped. I went back to Huntington and tried to find Sarah and—
Who is Sarah?
Sarah is my fiancée. I tried to find her and my mother and got on a boat that was leaving Huntington. I didn't know if they would be on board or not, but it was leaving and I didn't have any time to make a decision.
That still doesn't answer why you are in the river.
I found my mother and Sarah, and a bunch of other women being kept prisoner on the ship. I tried to kill one of the guards and take his keys, but he made too much noise and help came. Tweed had his men beat me. They were going to kill me, but I jumped overboard.
What was the name of the boat? Did you see any markings on the side of the boat?
She asked.
The King's Archer.
The King's Archer? And Tweed was on board. Are you sure?
Yes, I saw him.
How long ago?
The woman demanded.
I don't know, maybe 15 minutes ago?
All hands to your stations,
the woman yelled.
Feed the boilers, get her red hot.
The crew leapt into action, scurrying every which way as they moved to carry out her orders. The two men remained next to Kenny, gripping him by the arms.
Let him go,
she said to the two holding him.
Kenny, I don't know what quirk of fate brought you here today, but I'm inclined to believe it was divine providence. When we saw you floating in the river, I thought you were one of Tweed's crew. We sunk one of his riverboats less than 5 miles up the river. Most of them jumped overboard and swam to shore.
The woman extended her hand and shook his hand with a surprisingly strong grip.
I'm Captain Paddy O'Donnell, and this is my ship. Most of the crew are my sons and nephews. Come to the wheelhouse with me and we'll talk more.
But what are you going to do?
Kenny asked, still uncertain. Captain O'Donnell paused on the stairwell, turning back to address him.
We're going to catch up to the King's Archer, and I'm going to make Tweed pay for what he's done to my family.
Her eyes blazed with such an intense anger that Kenny was convinced she meant what she said. She ran up the flight of steps leading from the main deck to the wheelhouse, and Kenny dashed up after her. She threw a lever all the way forward, and the riverboat's paddle wheel churned faster, propelling them down the river in pursuit of the King's Archer.
Tweed sunk one of my boats, beat my brother nearly to death, and then burned our family business to the ground. I want payback,
she growled.
Tell me more about this business with the kidnapping. How did you know your fiancé was taken to the warehouse?
Kenny relayed the story of tracking down the highwayman to the bar, and then the trail that led to the warehouse. Captain O'Donnell ground her teeth together as she listened to his story, scanning the river ahead like a hawk for any sign of the King's Archer.
That son of a bitch. I knew Tweed was pushing people out of the shipping business and railroads for the last couple of years. Recently, he's become even more aggressive, sinking ships and destroying property. But kidnapping? Slavery? That's a new low even for him,
Captain O'Donnell said.
My niece, she disappeared last year. I wonder if...
Captain O'Donnell said. She gnashed her teeth together, and her cheeks flared.
Don't worry, Kenny. We'll catch Tweed and put a stop to this.
You have to be careful. The Martin Hale men on the King's Archer have guns. And with all of the people imprisoned on that ship, you have to be careful and not put them in the crossfire, Kenny said.
We'll be careful, but we've got to stop him. There's no way to avoid a gunfight.
I need to go on board again and free Sarah and my mother, he said.
Captain O'Donnell leaned out of the wheelhouse and yelled down to a crewman.
Pete, bring this boy a gun. Oh, and get him some damned pants, too. He's going over with the boarding party.
Turning to Kenny, she said,
When we board, you show the crew where the prisoners are and make sure they all get off Tweed's ship safely. You look like you're about done in from your go-around earlier with Tweed's men. Let my men take care of Tweed. You see to your mother and fiancé.
Kenny wanted to confront Tweed and make him pay for all that he'd put Sarah and his mother through. Sarah's parents were dead, and Tweed's men had beaten them both. He knew Captain O'Donnell was right, though. He was in no shape to be on the front lines of the fight.
All right. Thank you for your help. I thought there was no hope.
Captain O'Donnell spun the wheel and turned the massive riverboat to follow a bend in the river, her ship racing downstream as it moved with the river's current. The outline of a steamship became visible as they rounded the bend, a thick black cloud of smoke rising from its smokestack.
Don't give up hope. Not yet.
Paddy leaned out of the open wheelhouse door and yelled to the crew below.
All hands, prepare to board.
Chapter 21 A cloud of dust rose into the air, kicked up by the hooves of 100 horses, obscuring the valley below. Chief Bud Howell raised his arm up high above his head and pointed to the left and to the right, signaling to the massive posse gathered behind him that it was time to split up and move into their assigned positions. 20 members of the posse remained with Howell, their horses stomping restlessly as they waited for the other groups to get into position. The animals seemed to pick up on their owner's tension. As a strong wind drove the cloud of dust away, Howell brought his powerful binoculars to his face, scanning a clearing at the far side of the valley. Dozens of horses and riders were gathered there. Their individual features were indistinguishable from each other at this distance, but Howell picked out what he was looking for. A horseman waved a red flag above his head. Roy, leading the other half of the posse, signaled their readiness. Howell raised his own flag high over his head, waving it about. Through his binoculars, he saw that Roy had tossed his flag to the ground, their signal that everyone was ready and they would move on Bachman Detention Facility immediately. Chief Howell dropped his flag and pulled a metal flask from his jacket, swigging a drink of corn whiskey before he stuck the flask back into his jacket pocket. His nerves were shot, and he was at the limit of his mental reserves, utterly exhausted He had no willpower left to fight his craving. 2 days ago, he'd made the trip back to Wheeler. On the way, he bought a second horse from a farm a few miles away from the prison camp for the fat Martin Hale guard to ride. As promised, by the time they arrived at the farm, the man's feet were blistered and raw from walking up and down the steep mountain trails Howell had taken to get there. Howell swapped his horse for a fresh mount and tied the prison guard on the second horse. The fat guard's punishment wasn't over, though. He'd never ridden a horse before, and when they arrived in Wheeler, the man was bawling like a baby, his behind riddled with saddle sores. Howell had been relieved to see that Roy and his crew had kept to their schedule and were already in town when he arrived. He filled Roy in on what the situation was. It took some persuasive arguing to keep Roy from rushing into the prison camp with only the few men they had at their disposal. Roy was understandably frantic at the news that his son might still be alive, imprisoned in the camp. Howell laid out his plan to gather the prisoner's kin together, and Roy had reluctantly agreed. Dividing the stack of letters from the prisoners' families up between Roy, himself, and 4 members of the Joker's hangmen, they rode to each farm, convincing the relatives to help, one by one. Each of them traveled to another residence listed on the letters. By the end of the next day, Howell had an army composed of over 100 armed and outraged people at his disposal. It was a motley crew, to be sure, but they were unified in purpose by their desire to free their loved ones and punish those responsible. The air seemed to be charged with electricity, rife with tension. The fathers, mothers, brothers, and wives of the missing prisoners rode horses, carrying shotguns, rifles, pistols, and various handheld weapons. They outnumbered the Martin Hale prison guards 2-1. They were armed to the teeth and had the element of surprise on their side. It was now or never. Howell had to get them moving before they were spotted or the guards would have time to mount a defense. "There's a signal. Let's move out," Howell said. He took one last drink from his flask and spurred his horse on. The posse thundered down the worn gravel road, kicking up a massive cloud of dust that masked their approach to the facility. As they reached the outskirts of the camp, a cry went up from the guards keeping watch at the perimeter. A few of them pulled their pistols out and fired, but they were quickly shot or rode down by the posse, trampled underneath the heavy hooves of the horses. Chief Howell led the group with him to the camp's administrative building. As they neared the building, guards broke out the windows and opened fire. Shots rang out around him. He pulled the reins, did a tight turn to the left, and charged for the cover of nearby trees. Most of the others in his group followed him, although a few kept riding towards the building, opening fire with shotguns and pistols from horseback. 2 members of his posse were cut down before they made it close enough to hit anything with their return fire, and a 3rd man was shot in the back as he realized his mistake and turned to retreat. Howell slid down from his saddle and ran behind a large tree. He smacked the horse on the backside and watched it retreat to a safe distance up the hill. Unslinging his Remington 700, he brought the weapon to his shoulder and knelt in a shooting position, using the tree's trunk as an anchor point to steady his aim. He estimated the distance to the administrative building to be 70 yards. Howell watched the windows, looking for a target. One of the guards fired a shotgun at the posse through a broken-out window, then ducked behind cover. The guard hadn't been trained well, or he wouldn't have presented his entire body in the window when he fired. Instead, he would have only exposed what he needed to aim and fire. It was about to be a fatal mistake. His target selected, Howell kept his sights on the window and waited. The guard showed himself in the window, and as he brought his shotgun up to his shoulder, Howell squeezed the trigger, sending a .308 caliber bullet through the man's chest, dropping him instantly. Members of the posse next to him followed his lead and opened fire from the cover of the trees. Many of the rounds hit the side of the building, or went wide, but they at least provided him covering fire and allowed him to concentrate on taking out the men inside the building. Howell methodically shot each and every guard that exposed himself until no more dared to show their faces. He watched the building for a while, ensuring that there were no more combatants inside. With no targets left in the building, Howell's team ceased fire, but in other parts of the camp, hostilities still raged. The soft pops of pistol fire were heard amongst the larger boom of shotguns and crack of rifle fire, echoing throughout the valley. Suddenly, a huge explosion rocked a building 100 yards to the right of the administrative building. A massive shockwave went through the air, nearly knocking Howell off his feet. The explosion blossomed into an orange and red fireball that expelled black smoke as it rose into the sky. The explosion must have come from the meth lab he'd found, likely a result of a stray round from a gun battle breaking a beaker of some unstable chemical. Howell shrank behind the tree and shielded his face from the debris that came raining down a few seconds after the explosion. After the falling debris died down, he peeked out and saw the ruins of the meth lab burning brightly. Other nearby buildings began to burn, their roofs ignited by the flaming debris thrown free from the explosion. The front door of the administrative building opened a hair, and someone inside waved a white T-shirt through the open space. A voice called out from within,
"Don't shoot! We give up! We surrender!"
Chief Howell trained his rifle on the open doorway, ready to respond if the Martin Hale guards tried to pull a fast one. Some of the posse members closer to the administrative building shouted a response to the guard's surrender.
"Drop your weapons and come out with your hands up!"
There were a few tense moments where nothing happened, and then a single guard came out holding the white T-shirt. He took a few tentative steps outside the doorway, looked about nervously, and then walked forward with his arms held high. Two other Martin Hale guards followed him, waiting to see how the first guard was received. The men slowly moved away from the building. Seeing no signs of any weapons on the men, Chief Howell lowered his rifle and stood up, preparing to take custody of the surrendering guards. Shouts rose above the distant gunfire, some argument among the posse members closest to the building.
"Die, you sons of bitches!"
a posse member yelled. Some of the posse members opened fire on the unarmed guards. The guards screamed as they were riddled with bullets, their faces masks of disbelief as they died.
"No, damn it!"
Howell yelled, scowling at the posse members still shooting at the dead guards. Howell shook his head in disgust. He knew there would be bad blood when he brought these family members on board with the posse, but it was a shock to see. It was a risk he had to take to raise a force and free the prisoners. The shooting of unarmed men sickened him, but he knew some of these family members would be out for retribution for what was done to their kin. Ugly as it was, he felt little sympathy for the dead men. They had it coming to them. Not a single man among them could claim ignorance or innocence of the prisoners' treatment. What they had participated in was reprehensible and unforgivable, an ultimate abuse of power.
"Let's go see if they need help up at the mine," Chief Howell said, motioning to the posse.
It was the only place he still heard gunfire. After the meth lab exploded, there had been a brief exchange of gunfire, and then the area was silent. Good riddance. They followed the gravel road to the mine, and Howell passed several freed prisoners walking away from the mine. The men's gaunt and dirty faces were blackened by coal dust, looking up at the posse in disbelief and awe. Something else was present in their eyes besides that hollow look. He saw hope there, that their nightmare might finally be over. One of his posse members, a gray-haired man wearing jean overalls and a baseball cap, rushed forward and seized a thin prisoner in a bear hug. Wide-eyed, the prisoner asked cautiously, "Dad?" The gray-haired man roared, crying as he clutched his son. The sight spread murmurs and cries of sympathetic joy amongst the posse, and they began to look around for their own missing loved ones. Chief Howell wiped the sweat from his brow with a shaky hand and took the flask of whiskey from his pocket, drinking until the sweet liquid built up the calming and familiar heat in his chest. Strengthened, he continued up to the mine, witnessing other tearful reunions. Word must have gotten to the men deep in the mine because streams of prisoners came out of the pitch-black hole in the side of the mountain. Chief Howell watched them trickle out. Posse members stood outside in the sunlight, intensely searching the faces of the emerging men, looking for familiar faces. Roy was there, foremost among the posse, standing in the deep shadow of the mine. Roy's head swiveled from side to side in search of his son. Howell could see the conflict on Roy's face. The man had dropped the angry and tough shell he wore to keep others at bay. Roy's eyes gleamed with tears, and his face showed his worry and fear. The stream of prisoners coming out of the mountain slowed to a trickle, and after a while, no more emerged. Dozens of families outside of the mine hollered, whooped, and yelled, reunited with their families.
Others weren't so lucky, and they clung to each other, consoling one another in their grief. The families passed words of comfort around, and reminders that there could still be other Martin Hale prisons to shut down. Their loved ones might be out there. Roy, who had been standing alone in the mouth of the cave for several minutes now, walked into the darkness, passing from sight. Chief Howell knew how devastated he was. He knew the feeling of losing a son, and couldn't imagine what it felt like to lose a son and to not know his fate. Howell was torn as to whether he should go find Roy and try to comfort him, or whether his presence would only serve to open old wounds and enrage him. An ear-shattering shout erupted in the darkness, echoing from the mine. Howell winced, expecting the worst. A moment later, Roy emerged from the darkness. A prisoner leaned on his shoulder for support, Roy's arm around him as the younger man hobbled out of the mine. Roy's face was split with a wide grin, and he repeatedly looked over at his son, as if to see if he was still really there, or it was a trick of his mind and his son would disappear. A great weight lifted from Chief Howell's chest, as if he'd been freed of a terrible burden. He'd come expecting the worst for Roy's son. It had been years, after all, and he had held out little hope of finding him. His own face lit with a smile, Chief Howell took his flask out and drained it. His debt was paid. Chapter 22 Kenny stood just outside the wheelhouse of the Dawn Till Dusk, staring intently at the massive outline of the ship in front of him. A cloud of smoke and steam rose from her smokestacks, and her paddle wheel left a wide band of roiled water directly in her wake. The King's Archer was in his sights. Sarah and his mother were on the ship, as well as Tweed. He clung to the rails with a sweaty grip, his hands shaking with anticipation at the coming confrontation. The Dawn Till Dusk gave off creaks and groans as its steam engine was pushed to its limits. The ship streaked down the river like an arrow, the log extending from the front of the ship like the blade of a knife, aimed directly at the paddle wheel of the massive ship in front of her. The King's Archer stayed its course, steaming down the center of the Ohio River. Even if the crew had been aware of the danger, there was no way the larger ship could outrun Captain O'Donnell's smaller and faster ship. The King's Archer was designed for one purpose, to be the biggest freight hauler on the Ohio River. 60 yards of open water separated the mammoth ships, closing rapidly. Kenny's pulse pounded in anticipation as he watched the two ships grow closer and closer together.
"Brace for impact!"
Captain O'Donnell yelled. Kenny clung to the doorframe of the wheelhouse and bent his knees, but was wholly unprepared for the amount of force generated as the two ships collided. His hands were ripped away from the doorframe and he was thrown across the deck of the ship. His body slipped underneath the deck railing, and he hooked his arms and leg around the rail at the last moment, preventing himself from dropping into the river 10 feet below the second deck. The noise of the impact was ear-shattering. Splintering wood, twisting steel, and the crack of broken deck boards filled the air. The log tied to the Dawn Till Dusk's bow was jammed deep into the back of the King's Archer, wreaking havoc as it prevented their paddle wheel from turning. The Archer's engine strained and groaned against the log jammed in the paddle wheel, but the log wouldn't budge. A deep grinding sound filled the air, as if steel beams had been shoved into an oversized pencil sharpener. Finally, the pressure became too great, and the Archer's steam engine exploded. The side of the ship erupted, forced outward and upward as the huge steel boiler ripped through the ship's thick oak planks as if they were wet cardboard. The boiler was thrown 50 feet into the air and landed in the river with a hissing sound as the red-hot metal was quickly extinguished. A cavernous hole was left behind, exposing the ruined remains of the engine room. Victor Tweed and his crew appeared at the railing on the top deck, peering down at the gaping hole in the ship and the ruined paddle wheel behind the boat. Tweed's face was a mask of rage as he shouted orders at his crew. He lifted his gaze, following the log rammed into his ship, up the bow of the Dawn Till Dusk, until he stared Kenny right in the eyes. A look of surprise crossed Tweed's face. His shock didn't last long, and Tweed ran a finger across his throat, glaring hatefully across the water.
"Cut it loose!"
Captain O'Donnell yelled. On the deck below, the crew set to work with axes and saws,
cutting loose the heavy ropes binding the log to the bow of Dawn till dusk. When the last rope was cut away, her crew gave the all-clear sign. Kenny got to his feet and made his way to the wheelhouse, just in time to feel the deck lurch beneath him as Captain O'Donnell put the engine in reverse and the ship began to pull away from the King's Archer. Once the two boats were separated, she thrust the engine into gear and spun the wheel, coming alongside the King's Archer.
"Get ready to board,"
O'Donnell yelled. The crew tossed hooks and ropes over to the King's Archer and drew them together. O'Donnell killed the power to the engine and let the river's current and momentum push them the last couple of yards together.
"Come on, Kenny. We don't want to miss the action."
Kenny ran down the stairs to the first deck and then joined the crush of the O'Donnell crew as they climbed over the rails and ran across planks laid between the two ships. Gunfire erupted, and men scattered in all directions as they moved for cover or returned fire. Pete, Captain O'Donnell's oldest son, charged forward with two of his crew on his heels. A Martin Hale guard came around the corner and opened fire with a pistol. One of Pete's crew was hit in the arm, but raised his pistol and returned fire. Before the guard fired a second shot, Pete cut him down with a blast of buckshot from his shotgun. Chaos ruled the lower decks as the two crews fought with pistols, shotguns, knives, and even their bare hands. Kenny raced to the center of the ship, to the locked bays where he had last seen Sarah and his mother. As he rounded the corner, a man with an axe rushed towards him, swinging it wildly. Kenny skidded to a halt and arched his body backward. The axe blade whistled as it carved a path an inch in front of his face, sinking deep into the ship's wooden wall. The man pulled at the axe to free it, but before he could free it, Kenny brought his pistol up and shot the man three times at point-blank range. The guard fell to the floor. Kenny searched the still twitching man's body, rifling through his pockets, and took a pair of keys. He ran down the central hallway until he came to the cell where his mother and Sarah had been earlier. Kenny threw the door open, only to find the two women were gone. Panic set in. He fought against his fear of what could have happened to Sarah, trying to stay calm and rational.
"Please help us. You have to help us,"
a woman pleaded with him. Kenny shook free of the fear paralyzing him, and he fumbled with the keys as he struggled to find the one that fit the lock to her shackles.
"My mother and..." "Yes, I know them. Amy and Sarah. The man in the suit and his guards came and took both of them away. You must hurry," she said.
Kenny finally fit the correct key into the shackles and unlocked the woman's hand and foot bindings.
"Here, give me those keys. I'll set the other women free. Go now. Find them,"
the woman said. Kenny ran across the deck, sidestepping a struggle between a Tweed crewman and one of the O'Donnell men, then raced up the steps to the second deck. Kenny tripped up the last two steps, banging his shin painfully on the hardwood. As he scrambled to his feet, he heard Sarah cry out. Kenny searched the first two rooms he came to on the upper deck before he found a room with a brass sign reading Captain's Quarters. He kicked open the door. Sarah was tied to a chair in front of a desk, and Victor Tweed stood behind the desk, holding Amy in front of him at gunpoint, using her as a human shield.
"Don't do anything stupid, or I'll blow your mother's brains out," Tweed said.
"Please don't hurt my son,"
Amy cried.
"Shut up!"
Tweed moved the gun from Amy's head, pointing it at Kenny.
"You and the rest of those savages destroyed my ship. Now listen to me, punk, and listen good. You're going to give me that other boat. You go tell O'Donnell I'm taking it. You tell her to get all of her men off of that ship and turn it over, or I'll kill these two. She's not going to let you take her ship, even if I told her to. Let them go and..." "You deaf kid," Victor shouted. "Don't think I won't kill them. Get O'Donnell and tell her what I said."
Kenny looked from Sarah to his mother, fearful for their lives. Tweed was holding his mother too close for him to get off a clean shot. It was too risky. He might hit her. He was about to leave the captain's quarters and fetch O'Donnell when he saw his mother's eyes widen expressively and look down, as if she were telling him something. Kenny followed her gaze down to her right hand. She held four fingers extended and then pulled one back. It was a countdown. With 3 seconds left, he brought his gaze back up to meet Tweed so that Tweed wouldn't catch on to whatever it was she was about to do. Kenny was in the dark as well. He would just have to trust her and be ready to react.
"Listen, Mr. Tweed,"
Kenny said, trying to buy time.
"I can't go back to Captain O'Donnell and..."
Her countdown finished, Amy violently threw her head against Tweed's face. A sickening crunch filled the air as the hard bone at the back of her skull broke Tweed's nose. She twisted out of his grip and seized his gun arm, pointing it off in a harmless direction. Tweed fired his gun, but Amy clung to his gun arm, keeping it aimed at a wall. Now that his mother had twisted off to Tweed's side, he had a clear shot. Kenny brought his pistol up lightning fast and fired three shots into Tweed's chest. His nose still bleeding profusely, Tweed wore a look of shock and let his pistol fall from his grip. He looked down at his chest, clutching at his tie and suit jacket as he tried to open his shirt. Three neat holes formed a perfect triangle in the center of his chest and began to stain his white button-up shirt bright red. With a last gurgling attempt at breath, Tweed fell to the floor, dead. Kenny rushed to Sarah and hugged her tightly. The feel of her hair in his face and the delicate smell of her lilac-scented perfume was more than his overloaded senses could handle. He pulled back from her and looked at her face. All of his anxiety left him as he saw her smile.
"What took you so long, Kenny?"
his mother asked, smirking. Kenny shook his head and laughed. The excitement over, his adrenaline rush began to subside. The sound of gunfire became less frequent on the deck below as the battle drew to a close. With Sarah and his mother safe, a wave of exhaustion came over him. The pain in his ribs and hands throbbed insistently. His muscles were cramped and aching, pushed to their limit by the struggle to stay afloat in the Ohio River. All he wanted to do was lay down and sleep. Chapter 23 Carrying loads of wooden planks and steel parts along a pier, repair crews climbed the scaffolding attached to a pair of massive riverboats floating alongside the bank of the Ohio River. The riverboats were moored to a long pier, situated close to the O'Donnell family home and business. Men worked diligently, replacing damaged decking and support timbers on the dawn till dusk. Next to the second ship, a steam-powered crane hoisted a new boiler into the air, cautiously guiding the steel tank through a hole in the hull. Other men carried armloads of steel pipe into the hold, and a man on the second deck was hard at work, painting over the ship's old name. Captain Patty O'Donnell crossed the plank, crossing over from the pier to the second ship, appraising the painter's work.
"No, no, no. Don't paint over the whole thing. I want a big red X painted over that. Paint the new name over there,"
Patty yelled at the painters.
"But if I just put an X over it, people will be able to see the old name. Are you sure that's..."
"That is exactly what I want. I want everybody to see whose ship this was and who owns it now. Put the new name right over there,"
Captain O'Donnell said, pointing to an unpainted section of the wheelhouse. The painter shook his head and went back to work, painting a broad red X over the script of the ship's old name. The painter finished the crude edit and began to outline the ship's new name in stylish, flowing script. His paint strokes quickly took shape, and Patty smiled at the results. The Queen's Prize. Her oldest son, Pete, had dubbed the new ship, a far more fitting name than the King's Archer. The ship was hardly compensation for the loss of everything Tweed had destroyed, but it was a start. After inspecting the work being done to install a larger steam boiler and paddle wheel into her new ship, O'Donnell returned to the wheelhouse of the Dawn till Dusk, where she felt most at home. Looking out over the burnt husk of the old warehouse and fishery, her gaze shifted, resting on the new buildings being constructed 100 yards away. Carpenters were hard at work unloading timber from wagons, reclaimed lumber they took from an abandoned building in town. They would rebuild, start again, just as she had done after her husband died, and as they all had after the EMP. This was just one more speed bump in the road of life. For generations, the O'Donnell family had been survivors. They understood what it took to overcome the odds. Survivors didn't rely on luck, and understood they wouldn't win every battle. What made a survivor succeed was picking yourself up off of the ground and getting back up on your feet after each and every stumble, long after others had given up. Survivors were defined by their stubborn refusal to quit. It was as simple as that. She glanced over at the Queen's Prize, remembering the vicious battle to take the ship. Fate had intervened, handing her an opportunity to take action against Tweed. Her sense of justice in the world had been restored by his downfall. She wouldn't let the family business be endangered again. O'Donnell had a plan, a vision of the future she wanted to help build. As soon as the two ships were repaired and her own affairs were in order, she would find the riverboat captains that Tweed had pushed out of the business. She would convince them to seize their old ships and begin again. What they all needed was an alliance of independent riverboat captains, something larger than themselves, something meaningful to ensure that this would never happen again. There was a power vacuum right now, similar to what had existed and allowed Tweed to come into power. That vacuum would be filled, but she would make sure it was filled by people with a different set of values than Tweed's. For all the damage it had done, the EMP had also done some good. It had leveled the playing field for the little people. Their labor was now much more valuable to the community. Captain O'Donnell was in no hurry to see big business and people like Tweed come back into power and profit at the expense of the common man. Chapter 24 Chief Howell sat behind a desk covered in stacks of papers and hand-drawn maps, scowling at the disordered mess laid out before him. He couldn't concentrate. His mind kept turning away from the work at hand, daydreaming of a glass of whiskey in hand and a nice cool spot in the shade. The hunger inside of him for a drink was powerful, but he forced himself to focus on what needed to be done and purge the need from his mind. His own addiction put a fine point on why it was so important that he focus. In the rows of tents of the former detention facility, more than 200 men were hours away from experiencing the first stages of withdrawal. Howell had little time to waste. He had to come up with a plan to feed, house, and care for the men while the highly addictive drug left their systems. The meth lab run by the Martinhale guards had gone up in flames during the fight to free the prisoners. Initially, the destruction of the lab was the last thing he thought of as a problem, until he was faced with the proposition of 200 men experiencing cold turkey withdrawal. After months, and in some cases years, of being dosed with high-potency methamphetamines, their bodies expected to receive the drug like clockwork. There was no more of the drug left, and with no meth lab, there was no way to manufacture enough of the drug to wean all of them off. It was a crisis that needed to be dealt with immediately. A brown-haired woman walked through the bullet-hole-ridden doors of the detention facility administrative office and tossed a stack of paper down in front of Howell, putting her hands on her hips.
"Here's the list you asked for. I don't know how to put this any other way, but 20 of them aren't going to make it until the morning. They would have died whether we freed them or not. 50 of them are so thin and weak that they are at risk of dying from dehydration and malnourishment during withdrawal. The rest of them should be fine as long as we can keep them hydrated. It's a real mess."
"Thank you, Dottie. Let's call the families together this afternoon and prepare them for the worst, and then fill them in on the recovery plan. Fortunately, we have plenty of shelter, clean water, and food. We need to let them know what to expect as their family members go through withdrawal, and how to support them best," Chief Howell said. The woman gave him a grim nod and then left. Howell was exhausted. He hadn't slept for more than an hour in the last 2 days. He wanted nothing more than to lie down and rest, but there was nobody else available with experience that could take charge of the situation. Hell, he was hardly qualified to organize something like this, but he was all those men had. Somehow, he had to help them through their ordeal, even if he could only provide them with food, shelter, water, and a safe place to stay while the drugs left their system. Skimming the report Dottie had left, the lines of text jumbled together and words danced about. His tired eyes wouldn't focus. He couldn't see clearly enough to read. Howell tossed the stack of papers on the desk and made his way out of the building. It was time to get out of the stifling heat of the office and see what it was they were up against. Chief Howell walked down a row of tents. A short distance from the administrative office, he saw a familiar face. Roy kneeled down next to his son, who lay in the grass just outside of the tent, his head propped up on a rolled-up jacket. Seth's face was pale, and his hands trembled. It looked like the early onset of withdrawal symptoms. Likely he had been towards the end of his shift in the mine and due for his second dose of the day when Howell and his vigilantes freed him.
"How is he holding up?" Chief Howell asked.
Roy sighed and ran his hand over his son's head, smoothing down his coal dust-streaked hair.
"I'll be back in a minute, Seth. I'm going to talk to the chief for a few minutes."
Roy got to his feet and cocked his head to the side, indicating he wanted to talk elsewhere. After they were out of earshot, Roy broke the news to the chief.
"He's thin as a rail and weak. They had these men strung out like you wouldn't believe. This is going to be a rough week.
I know it. We're going to do what we can for them and see that they all pull through. They've been worked like animals. All of them are weak. Come to the administrative center this afternoon and pass the word along that everyone should come. I need to make sure everyone is on the same page, he said.
Will do. And Chief, thank you for finding Seth. I won't forget it, Roy said.
Howell nodded, unsure of what to say. He watched Roy walk back to sit in the grass by his son and then paced around the rest of the camp, taking everything in. There was much left to do before the day ended. The dead from the morning's battle needed to be buried. 8 of his posse had died. All of the Martin Hale guards perished in or shortly after the battle. No trials had been required. The angry families had carried out swift retribution. Few of the prisoners or family members cared what happened to the guards' bodies, but Howell still talked them into burying the bodies so that they wouldn't spread disease over the coming weeks. The last thing they needed was an epidemic on their hands. Chief made his rounds of the camp, sick to the stomach by the inhumanity of what had been done to the men. Convicts or not, they were still human beings. There were probably more camps out there, just like this. The idea gnawed at his mind. Howell would send the word out to fellow law enforcement officials he knew he could trust and have the camps shut down one by one. And then he would make sure Victor Tweed and his accomplices were punished for what they'd done. After that, he would head home for some well-deserved rest and maybe hang his hat up for good once Jack was back in town. Chapter 25. A gust of wind blew through the open window of the small farmhouse bedroom, stirring Kenny from sleep. He opened his eyes and stared up at the underside of a bunk bed a couple of feet above him. His mind foggy, he was uncertain where he was for a moment. Eventually, he remembered he was in Danny's room, on the bottom bunk of the bedroom they now shared. He groaned and rolled over, stuffing his face into his pillow to block out the morning light. Even now, a week after the ordeal with Tweed, every muscle in his body was sore. Kenny settled back in and was on the verge of drifting back to sleep.
Pow!
A loud noise like a gunshot roused him immediately from sleep. Kenny sat bolt upright, smacking his head against the wooden frame of the top bunk. His pulse pounding, he looked around for signs of danger. Danny stood next to the bed, holding a shoe in his hand, smirking at him. So it wasn't a gunshot. It was his younger brother playing a prank. Apparently Danny had slapped the shoe against the side of the bunk bed frame, nearly giving Kenny a heart attack in the process.
"You awake?"
Danny asked.
"Danny, what's the matter with you?"
Kenny barked, rubbing his forehead.
"Mom said you should get up,"
Danny said.
"Now you're up?"
"Remind me why I saved your bacon back in Baltimore?"
Kenny asked, pulling his jeans on.
"Because I'm the son with the brains and the good looks? Mom would be devastated if something happened to me. Can you imagine if all she had was you?"
Danny asked. Kenny shook his head from side to side.
"Moron, I'll be down in a minute."
"Don't be too long. Sarah and Andrew have been up for an hour already,"
Danny said. Danny was having a lot of fun pushing his buttons. Now that they shared a room, Kenny was a captive audience. They had doubled up in Danny's bedroom to free up his old room for Sarah. Andrew used the spare bedroom down the hall. With their parents gone, Amy had insisted that Sarah and Andrew stay with them until the siblings were back on their feet. Andrew planned on going back to his parents' farm, but it was clear that he wasn't ready to go back there just yet. It was too soon after his parents were killed to be in the home that carried so many memories. He was still reluctant to even talk about what had happened. It was a tight fit with that many people in the Miller's old farmhouse, but they spent most of their time working outside anyway, where space wasn't an issue. Kenny hadn't asked Sarah if she planned on going home when her brother left, but he hoped she would stay here with him. He wasn't ready to let her get too far out of his sight after what they'd been through. The thought of losing her was too much to bear. He never wanted to leave her side again. With his mother around, they were under constant supervision, but it was fine with him. Things had slowed down between them. Sarah needed to work through losing her parents, and Kenny knew she needed time to heal before she was ready to move on. If it took 10 years, he'd wait for her, and she was worth every minute of waiting. Kenny made his way downstairs and went into the kitchen, where his mother, Sarah, Andrew, and Danny all sat around the kitchen table eating breakfast.
"Good morning. We weren't sure if you were going to wake up again,"
Amy said.
Fortunately, I have a good alarm clock, otherwise I might have slept all day.
Danny gave an evil chuckle, glancing around the table. Kenny sat down and made himself a plate of food. There was cornbread in the bread basket, sliced ripe tomatoes, and a bowl full of scrambled eggs. He scooped a large helping of eggs onto his plate. It still seemed strange to him that everything they ate was grown right there on the farm.
"I'm going over to my folks' place to pick the ripe veggies and check on the house. I should be back by the afternoon," Andrew said.
Danny snorted, then looked over at Kenny and smirked. Danny's face turned beet red, and he turned away with a smile. They both knew that Andrew was going to see his girlfriend a few miles away, and that if Andrew even made it to his parents' farm, there would be very little to show for his vegetable-picking expedition. Kenny bit the inside of his lip to keep from smiling. His mother still didn't know, but it wasn't his job to fill her in on all of Andrew's business.
"I'll be down in the new field today with the mules. I've got some plowing to do," Kenny said.
Danny snickered and clapped his hand over his mouth to contain his laughter.
"I'll go with you and keep you company while you plow the field," Sarah said.
Danny stomped his foot underneath the table, his red face showing behind the hand clamped over his mouth.
"Danny, what's gotten into you?"
Amy asked. Danny pushed his chair back from the table and excused himself from breakfast. Kenny looked up from his plate of food, feeling his mother's gaze on him. Her eyes were narrow slits under a furrowed brow. She shook her head and sat down. Kenny spread his hands apologetically.
"What? What did I do?"
His mother made a plate of food, as red-faced as Danny had been.
"Anyway, I'll be working with the chickens this morning. A few of those hens are broody. I'm going to swap out some fertile eggs and let the ladies hatch some chicks. We've lost a few to foxes, so we need to bump up our numbers anyway. Take a basket lunch along if you think you two will be down there all day,"
his mother said.
"I'll pack one,"
Sarah said. Kenny finished his breakfast, put on his work boots, and went to the pasture where the mules greeted him at the fence. A lot of people thought mules were stubborn animals, but he knew they just had a longer memory and were less forgiving than horses. If you mistreated them, they would never forget it. It worked the other way as well. He always had an apple or some other treat ready for them in his pocket, so they were always happy to see him. He grabbed the tack from the stable, and after a few moments of tacking their harnesses, he led the mules through the gate over to the house. Sarah was waiting there for him, a picnic basket in her hand. She smiled at him. It was the first time she'd smiled in a week. Kenny's pulse quickened. They walked in silence over the crest of a hill and down to the new section of field Kenny had cleared. Sarah set the lunch basket down in the shade of a tall oak tree near a small creek that ran through the narrow valley. A work table sat under the tree, and Sarah picked up an unfinished hand-woven basket. She took a slender switch from a tall stack of willow branches on the table and wove it into the basket. She was a natural at weaving, completely self-taught. Everybody in town wanted her baskets. Each one was a work of art and had a different pattern of light and dark branches woven together into intricate patterns.
"Have fun. Don't work too hard," Sarah said.
Kenny smiled and led the mules over to the field. He hitched the mules up to the plow and set the blade into the earth. He looked over every minute or two, checking on her, but the mules drew his attention away. The animals were antsy, stomping about nervously, their ears pulled back tight against their heads. Kenny wondered what the issue was, but pushed the thought aside. About to command the mules to pull the plow, he paused. Something itched at the corner of his mind, a nagging nuisance that bugged him. Absently scratching at the nearly healed wounds on his arm, Kenny looked down and realized what it was bothering the mules. Wasps. The stings on his arms had nearly healed, and after the larger misadventures of the past week, he'd nearly forgotten about the wasp nest he and the mules had unearthed. The mules hadn't forgotten a thing. He looped their lead on a nearby stump and walked up and down the field, looking for any signs of the insects. As he walked across the freshly turned soil, he thought back to when he walked the field years ago with Wyatt, listening to his stories. Every field, glen, and winding path through the woods on the old homestead held some memory of Wyatt. During the short time he'd been with the family, he'd become like a second father to Kenny, teaching him everything he knew about hunting, fishing, nature, self-reliance, and the human condition. Kenny missed him greatly, and wished that Wyatt could see the results of the hard work his family had done around the farm, how productive and full of life it was. 3 years of hard work had turned it into a true homestead, capable of sustaining the family.
It hardly seemed fair that Wyatt wasn't here to witness it and enjoy the results. Without him, Kenny couldn't imagine what would have happened to his father or the rest of his family. It wasn't fair that they were here and Wyatt was gone, but he knew that very little in life was fair. People who deserved to live died, and people who deserved death lived. He'd been bitter about Wyatt's death for a long time, but it was time to let it go. It's what Wyatt would have wanted him to do. Floating in the Ohio River after he'd jumped overboard to avoid being beaten to death by Tweed's men, he had been in a dark place, bitter about human nature. After Captain O'Donnell and her crew had plucked him out of the river, he'd half wanted to jump back in, suspicious and untrusting. But working together with Captain O'Donnell, Tweed got what was coming to him. Self-reliance had its place, but trusting in others and having faith in the goodness of humanity, most of them at least, had allowed them to stop Tweed. Without each other, Kenny and O'Donnell might never have succeeded in killing Tweed and saving his prisoners. Satisfied that there were no more wasp nests in the field, Kenny took up the lead and set the mules to work. The plow left a mound of dirt behind it as it furrowed a path in the field, turning the black bottomland soil over as it went. The smell of the dark soil was earthy and rich. Every few feet, the plow would kick over a large stone before continuing on, jarring his arms up to the elbows. By the end of the day, his arms would be numb, but the effort would be well worth it. Wyatt had been right about the field. More than once he'd said that the real treasure was in the black soil of this field. It was rocky, but once Kenny plowed it and removed all the field stones, it would by far be the most productive land on the homestead. A few hours later, he finished plowing a quarter of the field and then unhooked the mules from the plow. It was nearing midday, and the animals deserved some water and a break. He brought them down to the creek and let them drink from the cool flow, and then lashed them in the shade of a tall tree so they could graze the green grass there. Kenny picked up his shovel and crowbar and went back to the field to clear the large field stones. Sweat poured down his face and his body as he toiled in the hot sun. He went down each row, dropping his crowbar down into the soil a few inches, listening for the sound of metal hitting stone. When he found a stone, he pried up the offending rock and hauled it off to the edge of the field and added it to a growing pile of rocks there. Lost in his work, Kenny lifted the crowbar and dropped it down into the earth in search of more stones. Clink. The bar hit something solid a few inches under the soil, and a hollow metallic noise rang out that was quite unlike the gentle rapping it made against a stone. Curious, Kenny sank the crowbar down again and again, feeling out the edges of the object. He stuck the crowbar underneath the object and pushed down hard. A small metal box with rust-covered hinges popped out of the soil. Kenny brushed the loose soil off of the box and picked it up. There was a small lock on the box, its keyhole stuffed with soil and rust. Wondering what could be inside, he set the box on one of the large field stones he'd uncovered and used the crowbar to hammer at the lock. The lock, rusty as it was, disintegrated under the first blow. Kenny opened the box and found a cloth sack inside. The sack was heavy, and when he opened the drawstrings and dumped the contents into his hands, 30 large gold coins spilled into his palm, shining bright in the sunlight. Kenny's mouth went dry, and he felt lightness in his chest. Memories of Danny and him digging holes all over the homestead the year they arrived came back to him. Wyatt had teased them about buried treasure on the homestead. After Kenny grew bored with digging the holes, he assumed it was a game devised by Wyatt to keep him and his brother distracted from their hunger during the first hard winter. He never imagined it could be true. Wyatt had always said the real treasure was here in the rich soil of this field, and in typical Wyatt fashion, there was more than one layer of meaning to his words. He could almost hear Wyatt chuckling at the discovery. The coins were worth a fortune, a small treasure. There was way more than enough here to buy the plot of land for his farm. With this, he and his family could purchase cows, pigs, a few more horses and mules, and still have enough left over to buy land for Danny when he married, if any woman would have him. Sarah waved at him from the shade, lifting the lunch basket high for him to see. Kenny wrapped the coins back up and stuck them in his pocket. He waved back at her and walked over to meet her. He would wait until after their picnic lunch and a long break with her in the shade to tell her about the find. If he shared the surprise with Sarah now, she would want to walk up to the house and tell his mother, who would be overjoyed to hear of it. To him, the news could wait. His time with Sarah was worth more than its weight in gold. This concludes Retribution by John Winchester, narrated by Travis Baldry. Copyright 2017 by John Winchester. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Adept Solutions and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.